We Love Movies with Gordon Hayden.
Spin 103.8.
Now in We Love Movies, we're going to take a look at Jack Reacher Never Go Back, the second film in the Jack Reacher series. I wonder, could it be the last, though? I was even surprised they made a second film because it was quite mixed. But the thing was, that was when it came out in cinemas. And then it managed to catch fire when it went on video on demand and DVD, and it took on a complete life of its own. Hence why we now have the sequel. The film, the first film was made for about 50 million, and then it made over 200 odd million. So the powers that be were like, yeah, we'll have a sequel to that. Roy Cashin joins me in studio to take a look at it. So Roy, what is happening this time out for Jack?
Jack is having a bit of a phone relationship, let's say. He's struck up a friendship slash, let's see where this goes, with Cobie Smulders, who everyone should know from everything that she's been in, like the Avengers and stuff. And she is a major in the army. And he's heading up to Washington, D.C., potentially to take her out on a date. And just when he walks into her office, he finds out she's just been arrested for espionage. So he begins to investigate into why exactly it is that someone he, you know, because Jack Reacher, he gets a pretty good read of people. So for her to actually be a spy would be a bit of a shock. So he starts looking into it. And off the back of that, he then becomes a bit of a prime target for whoever it may be is trying to put shade on top of Cobie Smulders' character. Mm-hmm. And he might have a daughter, a 15-year-old daughter, that a woman has come into the army and claimed a paternity test against him, saying that she thinks this man is the father of her 15-year-old daughter. So he's got a lot going on.
It's like a soap opera as opposed to an action film. All right, here is a clip from Jack Reacher, Never Go Back.
Ma'am, these men are here to transfer you.
Who are they? Reacher?
These men are here to kill you.
Soldier! You know who I am.
You've been relieved of Turn. Command, ma'am.
No time.
I'm being held here without cause. It is your right to count. That soldier was under my command.
We don't have time for this.
I left explicit orders for you to stay away.
Orders? You ordered
me? Yes. I knew you'd do something like this.
Don't make me regret it.
You'd never want to go back with all that stuff going on, Rory.
Did you see what you said there? A soap opera instead of an action film?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Oh, no, Rory. This is not a good sign.
If you've seen the poster where there's an explosion.
Yeah.
Or maybe you've seen the trailer where there's an explosion.
A lot of crash bang.
When you watch the film, there is an explosion.
Oh.
That's pretty much the extent
of... It's not what I want from a Jack Reacher film.
No, because the first one had some pretty decent action bits. It had, remember that fight in the bathroom when no one could get a punch in because the room was so small? I thought that was great. Mm-hmm. The opening scene with the sniper, that like one take where he took out, was it like seven people with that one thing? He had that, he had the awesome car chase. At the stuff at the end with Joy Courtney and the big bad Werner Herzog, which was such odd casting. In this, the action is really, really poor. And it just felt really, really cheap, and the plot was really confusing while also not actually being about anything at the same time. When you actually find out the big bad guy's like overarching plot, you're like, what? Doesn't make any sense.
See, I think with the likes of Jack Reacher, it's a pulpy, trashy type of character and story, and you need someone with that type of sensibility to meld all of those subplots and the narrative together. When I heard Ed Zwick was given the gig as director, like, this guy has made a lot of worthy wannabe movies like Blood Diamond, Glory,
Last
Defiance,
Samurai.
Last Samurai, hence the connection there with Tom Cruise. But he has been out in the cold from Hollywood in a while, and it seems like his old mucker Tom Cruise is giving him a gig to get him back into the Hollywood standings again. And I never would have put Ed Zwick with Jack Reacher.
No.
It just seems like such an odd fit. You almost want some like the director, Pierre Noël or whatever his name is, Morelli, who made the first Taken movie.
Yeah, look, I would have said something maybe similar about Christopher McQuarrie for the first one, because, you know, he hadn't directed anything, or he had The Way of the Gun.
Okay.
But then previously to that, it was like Valkyrie and The Usual Suspects. So him being given like a pulpy novel thing just didn't sit well, and then he pulled it off. Mm-hmm. But Christopher McQuarrie, I suppose, is not comparable to Ed Zwick, who... I don't know. It was just lame. And when we were talking there earlier about how much the first one cost, I looked into it, 60 million for the first one,
okay,
which is, you know, not bad. Tom Cruise action thriller. I watched the second one. I was like, Christ, the budget must have been slashed, like absolutely slashed. $95 million.
What?
It cost 50% more. And I was like, where did that money go? There's no evidence of where that money went when you watch the film.
Oh no.
It's just bad. It is bad and not enjoyable. It's the worst performance I've seen Tom Cruise give in ages. Because I was trying to think even recently, like even the stuff that people don't like, Oblivion, Rock of Ages, he's always been good. And then he had like Edge of Tomorrow, the two Mission Impossibles. He's been on a little bit of a run. This has been his first proper bad film in a while.
The other thing about it is, and we mentioned this, and we even mentioned it in the original Jack Reacher review, is Tom Cruise not being the right fit for the part. Because Jack Reacher is this 6'7" character. You get the impression, because they don't go into too many details in the book, Lee Childs, about his appearance, but you feel that he is a sort of a, almost a scruffy, rough looking type of dude. And he's 6'7". He's a towering inferno of a man. And Tom Cruise is not that. He needs a stepladder in order to be Jack Reacher.
Yeah.
They need someone like Hugh Jackman or Liam Neeson, someone of
the
that
Rock
ilk. Yeah.
Is who comes to mind.
You know what I mean? You need someone like that to pull it off.
Yeah, an actual physical presence.
Mm.
Which is the exact opposite of this. And then I was talking to a friend of mine who's a massive Lee Childs fan, and he was explaining how the film had been announced before the book had even come out.
Right.
And then he had read the book, and it felt to him afterwards, it felt like Tom Cruise had gone to Lee Child and gone, listen, for this, I would like this to happen. I would like him to have a potential family dynamic. And my friend was like, it was a bad book. It was bad. And it felt like Cruise's influence potentially changed the course of what this Jack Reacher character would have normally been.
Okay.
Because you have like these, 20 odd other books that he could have chosen from, and instead decided to, adapt one that hadn't even come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It was
sounds kind of dodgy.
It does sound a bit odd.
Yeah. All right, Rory. Well, let's get scores then for Jack Reacher: Never Go Back.
4.
Yeah. Even the subtitle is very fitting, isn't it? Never Go Back.
After the first,
like
one,
never.
You should
Tom,
never have gone back.
Don't at all.
We love movies with Gordon Hayden.
Spin 103.8.
We have a horror movie to talk about. It's not so much a sequel, it's a prequel.
Yes, it's set in the 1960s. Ouija, Origin of Evil. Looks into... have you seen the original?
No. But I heard it was shocking.
It's not good.
And shocking, not in a good way.
No, not the way you would have liked for a horror film. And I feel your life is better having not seen it.
Okay.
But it is set in the same house as the original. And some of the backstory that we're told about in the original movie comes to light here. There is a family, a mother and her two daughters, and the mother is a bit of a charlatan. She brings people into her home pretending to be a kind of seance person and can talk to the dead, but she's all like play acting. She's her daughter's involved in blowing out the candles around the room and stuff like that. And one of her daughters says, why don't we get in a Ouija board that will help with the act that we're doing? It'll make it seem more legit. And the mother does, and she goes out and buys it, and it turns out that the youngest daughter is actually a bit of a medium, and at first begins to talk to what she believes is her dead father, but is in fact a nasty demon that is trying to take over the body of the daughter.
Okay.
And just wreak havoc around the place. And there's some other shady stuff that actually happened in the house, which I'm not going to get into, but when they tell you the story of it, you're like, why aren't we watching that film?
It's way more
interesting. But I digress.
Okay, well, listen, we'll come back to that digression in just a second, but here is a clip from Ouija, Origin of Evil.
Did you bring me up here to tell me my 9-year-old daughter is a fraud?
Not at all. When I asked for Gloria's middle name, I thought the word Lynn as hard as I could. I repeated it over and over in my mind.
Why would you do that?
Because when we ask a question we know the answer to, we think the answer as we ask it.
That's right. And she was listening to me. I don't think your daughter is a fraud. I believe she is channeling powers and forces we do not understand. But I'm certain she was not channeling my wife.
Now, Rory, the first film, Ouija, it did all right, but it got critically mauled.
Yes.
But it did make money.
Yes.
And I wonder, that do the producers think, okay, right, we got a hammering by the critics, but I think there's mileage in this series, so let's just almost pretend that that first film didn't happen, and now this series kicks off with this prequel.
Yeah, pretty much. And the one thing I will say is that they actually do try to do something a little bit different, because it starts off with the Universal logo. It's actually the 1960s Universal logo, the one from years ago. As the opening credits is that, you know, old school horror, like just a single frame kind of thing, where you'll know when you see it, you're like, oh, you're really going for the kind of retro, kitschy look. They have their little cigar burns up in the corner, lovely, which we haven't seen in films since, you know, they're actually shot on film. So they're really going for an old retro vibe. And even the story and the way it's presented to us is more 1960s horror than it is modern, because it takes its time introducing us to the characters, getting us to know them before, you know, like if it was a modern, let's say, Jason Blum production, like 5 seconds in and that cat has been thrown at the camera and you're already screaming all over the place. But no, it takes its time getting to it. And I kind of really appreciated that, because it's been a while since you've seen, you know, a kind of big Hollywood-ish horror movie where it is taking its time to, you know, set up the scares, set up the atmosphere. The only problem is, when the scares do eventually arrive, they're just not scary enough.
Okay.
And for a horror film, that's not great. But I almost commend the film for trying something completely new, because the stuff that it gets right, it does get really, really on point. And I was surprised walking out of it. I was like, I didn't hate that. I didn't hate it like I hated the first one.
Yeah.
It wasn't good enough, but it was still like exponentially better than the first one was.
The first film felt like a real cynical made horror movie.
Yeah.
It was almost like, okay, we'll take this, it's like we've board game, as it were.
We bought the rights to this somehow by accident. I feel like Michael Bay was told, like, you can have Transformers, but you have to take Ouija with you.
But Michael Bay's company, Platinum Dunes, they had been remaking a whole load of old horror movies, from A Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, the Amityville Horror. So for them to make Ouija, you think, oh, look, you know what I mean?
That's that now.
But do you think, Rory, that with that first film, it was very much made for entry-level teenagers getting into horror? Whereas this one, it's almost like, forget that audience, we're going for the proper horror fans.
Potentially, but you wouldn't know that from any of the publicity material, I don't think.
It's almost like, for me, looking at it, they've seen what's been going on with The Conjuring and thought, you know what, we want that audience.
Yeah.
That's where we're going for.
Yeah, and like that's clever, because it worked really well for the 1970s set stuff for The Conjuring. But The Conjuring's like mentality of horror is still very modern. Like you're still 3 minutes in and there's already something creepy happening. Whereas, like I said, with this, it takes its time. It's a good half hour before they really start like turning the screws.
Okay.
And, you know, it's not that scary. So even as you said, the first one was entry level horror, this one would be kind of the same. It's very what I call like a slumber party horror movie, where, you know, you're sitting around and you're 12 and you're like, blah, and everything, you're hiding behind pillows because you've never done a horror film before. But I appreciated the effort that went in, whereas with, you know, a very kind of cynical horror sequel, none of that would have been there. It would have just been like, and the board's back and it's alive and it's coming to get your house again. Whereas this one was just, you know, you could see someone tried something new, didn't entirely work out, but here you are.
They're going to get a good mark for the effort. Okay, Roy, so let's get those scores out of 10.
5.
All right, nice one, Roy.
We love movies with Gordon Haydick. Spin 103.8.